Hi, good afternoon. Welcome, everyone. Thank you for joining our ninth installment of GeoThink and Learn on the political economy of information and technology. My name is Sonia Solomon. I am the project manager at GeoThink, and I will be moderating today's panel. GeoThink is a SHRC partnership grant here at McGill University, headed by Professor Renee Sieber, and we focus on researching open data, GeoWeb, and changing city-citizen interactions. So I'll begin by welcoming our group of speakers, starting with our panel chair, who will convene today's meeting, GeoThink co-applicant Daniel Paré, associate professor in the Department of Communication, University of Ottawa. So as a co-applicant of GeoThink, Daniel's research and policy-related work focuses on the social, economic, political, and technical issues arising from innovations in information and communication technologies, or ICTs, in developing and industrialized countries. His areas of specialization include ICT and international development, e-commerce, internet governance, internet information and communication policy, e-government, and knowledge networks. Daniel is also the Open Government Partnerships Independent Reporting Mechanism researcher for the implementation of Ontario's Open Government Action Plan. So next, I'll introduce another GeoThink co-applicant, Leslie Shade, professor at the Faculty of Information, iSchool of the University of Toronto, and Associate Dean of Research. Professor Shade's research focus since the mid-1990s has been on the social and policy aspects of information and communication technologies, with particular concerns toward issues of gender, youth, and political economy. Her research promotes the notion of the public interest in ICT policy. Publications, community outreach, and student supervision have as their goal the promotion of a wider discourse. So her commitment is an ongoing one to building participatory scholar activist networks. And finally, closing today's panel will be Agnieszka Leszczynski, senior lecturer in Environment Faculty of Science at the University of Auckland, who is joining us all the way from New Zealand. So welcome. Professor Leszczynski is a critical geographer and trained spatial data scientist whose work integrates geographic information science and social economic geographies. She is the architect of the new field of digital geographies and a digital methods specialist. And her work is focused on the social, economic, and technological shifts associated with the commercialization of all things geo. She is currently researching the value of digital location in the platform economy and has a longstanding interest in changing social relations around geoprivacy and the changing demographics and geographies of digital economic knowledge worker migration. So before I pass it over to our panelists, I'll just outline a few ways that our attendees can ask questions during our event. So there are three ways. There is a raise your hand button on the top left of your screen. So this feature allows you to ask a video recorded question in real time to our panel. So you'll be asked to first accept a video and microphone share request on your screen. And please be advised that this will include consent to recording you on our feed. So if you prefer not to ask a recorded question, you can also send a written one through the Q&A button, also on the top left of your screen. So this same feature has an anonymous button, which sends a written question without noting your name if you prefer that as well. And finally, there is a general chat box that we will be using throughout the entirety of our session, and you can access this via the chat bar in the toolbar on your left. So unfortunately, some of these options are not available to those of you joining us via telephone, but you can always email us your questions or visit our website at geothink.ca or find us on Twitter at geothink.ca, where we'll be live tweeting some of the questions as well. So without further ado, I'll pass it over to our first presenter, which will be Leslie Shade.
Thank you. Is that full screen now?
Yes, it is.
It is. Okay, great. Thank you. Thank you, Sonia. What I want to talk today about is the political economy of the geo. think and give you a very, very brief introduction to the political economy of communication, and then talk about some ways that we're looking at a preliminary application of a political economic focus to Sidewalk Labs Toronto. And this is current work that I'm doing with some RAs at the Faculty of Information, many of them Masters of Information students in the Critical Information Policy Studies concentration. So that's Jamie Duncan, Marta Buchma, Lauren Ash, Dale Singh, and also Islandia Guzman, who is a doctoral student in the program at the Faculty of Information as well. And then let me go on. Earlier research on the political economy of the GeoWeb with Dr. Harrison Smith, now Dr. Harrison Smith, who is one of our early RAs on the project, and he's currently a research associate at the Global Urban Research Institute at Newcastle University. And this was a white paper that culminated called Open and Free, the Political Economy of the Geospatial Web 2.0, which you can download and take a look at there. And what this paper does is broadly look at what the political economy of communication is and how it can be applied to the GeoWeb. So in broad brushstrokes, the political economy of communication looks at the interrelationships between media, communication systems, and the broader social structures of society, and asks a lot of very large questions. How do these systems reinforce, shape, or challenge class relations? Who benefits within particular social, political, and economic contexts? Importantly, who doesn't benefit? What are the structural processes in the production, distribution, and consumption of communication? And political economy is also very much concerned with issues of media ownership, support mechanisms, and government policies, and how this influences media behavior and content, and asks a lot of questions about the structural factors and labor processes in the production, distribution, and consumption of communication. Now, taking from Vincent Mosco, who's written some of the most seminal work looking at the political economy of communication, and his three spheres of looking at political economy, commodification, spatialization, and structuration, Harrison applied these spheres in looking at the GeoWeb and looking at some of the ways that the GeoWeb was implicated in terms of commodification, producing goods for exchange or for sale, spatialization, how these technologies are spatially distributed, and structuration, what does this mean socially and economically in terms of who gets to participate. And the key takeaways from his white paper is that the GeoWeb is increasingly controlled by a handful of corporate bodies. So there's a large market dominance of, for instance, Google. So are these monopolies or oligopolies? There's a lot of issues in terms of the ownership of the GeoWeb with data standards and institutions for GeoWeb research, such as Open Geospatial Consortium. Geolocative data is a valuable commodity. It's used a lot for analytics. It's used a lot by marketing companies. But there's a lot of structural inequalities that persist. There's a lot of issues in terms of data and digital divides, and digital literacy is key. A lot of people can't participate with the GeoWeb because data literacy is a very complicated beast. Now, moving on to thinking about Sidewalk Labs. Sidewalk Labs was created in 2015 as Alphabet's urban innovation branch and incubator and investor, reimagining cities to improve the quality of life, is what they say. And Sidewalk Toronto was a partnership announced in 2017 between Waterfront Toronto and Sidewalk Labs, teaming up after a competition for, quote, innovation and funding partners, unquote. Sidewalk Labs has committed $50 million, that's about 64 million Canadian, in consultation and preparation over this year of 2017 to 2018. And the development hopes to, and I'm putting that in quotes, hopes to break ground in 2020 in Toronto's Quayside neighborhood. So there's a lot of activity and energy and issues that are arising from the Sidewalk Toronto partnership. It aims to tackle urban challenges, congestion, high cost of rent, affordability, environmental impacts, building in connected infrastructure, and lots of different sorts of urban informatics. There's a lot of material on their website that is available. There's lots of nice looking graphics and whatnot about it. But if we want to drill down and look at the political economy of Sidewalk Toronto, we have to, you know, go down and unpack this thing called Alphabet, which is part of Google. Google restructured in 2015 to become Alphabet. Google LLC handles the internet services business, which provides the majority of the company's revenue selling advertisements. Through its holding company, it has lots of different subsidiaries, including Sidewalk Labs. And a lot of these holdings are not particularly profitable, but they're very strategic in terms of the delivery of a lot of services that they might envision to undertake in the next few years. Drone delivery, health sciences, autonomous smart city technology, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Google, of course, is immensely powerful. It's acquired 89 companies since 2001 to bolster its market dominance. And it's got, you know, mega bucks of revenue, you know, only a mere $110 billion U.S. dollars for 2017. huge market capitalization. So they're the second most valuable publicly traded company in the world after Apple. Cut and paste here from cbinsights.com, looking at the sort of ownership structure of Alphabet and different sorts of initiatives and companies that they have, and looking in even more deep in terms of other sorts of holdings that Alphabet has across the sort of spectrum of Google offerings and whatnot. So it's quite deep. If we look at Sidewalk Labs, I'm not talking about Sidewalk Toronto, I'm talking about Sidewalk Labs. Their investments and acquisitions in the last few years have been quite interesting. They have invested in Spider Tech in April 2010, which is automated communications platform for law enforcement agencies. Now, these are all in the United States. The firm Cord is a spinoff to do urban logistics. So it's a platform with APIs that can support different sorts of rail, ride hailing, bike sharing, and other urban mobility challenges. So you wonder if they're trying to compete with Lyft and Uber and so on and so forth. The firm CityBlock is a spinoff in October 2017, which offers healthcare solutions for marginalized communities in the United States. And the firm Intersection through various acquisitions. And this provides lots of different sorts of urban connectivity, Link NYC kiosks, free public Wi-Fi spots, connected billboards, lots of ad revenue that comes in that regard. So there's information about Sidewalk itself. Now, the potential impact of thinking about Sidewalk Labs Toronto in terms of the political economy. If we're looking at Moscow's three spheres, we take one, commodification. We find that civic technology and urban innovation become proprietary to Sidewalk. So who owns this technology? Who owns this infrastructure? There's a lot of ways that open informatics can generate more profits than good due to digital and data divides. It creates a corporatization of public space. So you've got this idea, this tension between corporate smart cities versus open smart cities. And thinking about the webinar last week and the great work from Bloom Laurier and Landre and Open North and GeoConnections of looking at open smart cities, this idea of this open smart city flies in the face of corporate smart cities. Data becomes a commodified resource and it's not a public good. And so that's a key concern. And data governance as well is very key issue here. You've got loss of collection, disclosure, retention, ownership of personal information. How is this information collected? Is there meaningful consent? A lot of the issues in terms of talking about data governance talks about privacy by design, as if privacy by design is a Band-Aid that you can put onto this thing and everything's okay. Is that a resilient way to think about effective privacy controls? And then you've got this patchwork of legislation, federal, municipal, global, general GDPR that's coming online in the next couple of weeks, and what impact that might have. If we think about spatialization, we see where urban spaces are increasingly mediated by digital technologies that are proprietary. And you've got a lot of different sorts of horizontal and vertical integration with this defined sort of urban territoriality that's built in to the investors and sidewalk. Once again, data governance is a key issue here. Data sovereignty, data residency, these are prime issues that Canadians are very concerned about. What is the role of open data? What is the role of open standards? What is the role of interoperability, usability, user experience in terms of the development of these infrastructures? These are questions to be asked. In terms of structuration, there's a lot of issues in terms of, you know, how are our everyday lifestyles and urban settings shaped by the affordances of these smart city technologies? You know, what happens to this notion of citizenship and who gets to participate in the city? The sort of corporate logics of platformization can mediate our everyday experiences as we participate every day in the everyday city. So who gets to participate? Who's excluded? Once again, a lot of issues of concern in terms of digital and data divides, data and discrimination, data rights, privacy rights, and lots of issues like that. And planning and policy needs to integrate a wider civil society, you know, civic tech groups, activists and citizens, and so on and so forth. There's been a lot of great work that's been talked about in terms of the public interest perspectives of Sidewalk Toronto from the civic tech community, Pam Robinson, Renee Sieber, Bianca Wiley, Jean-Noël Landré, Rachel Bloom, Nasma Ahmad. There's been some great sorts of work there in looking at these issues. So there's fortunately some good energy to ask these hard questions about how this initiative may be developing and what the key concerns are in terms of the public good. So I will leave it at that and stop my share.
Great. Thank you, Leslie. There's already some Q&As coming in, so we'll get to those after. But I'll pass it over to Agnieszka.
Sorry, let me just... Thanks. Great. Is my mic on? It's on.
Correct? Yes, it is.
Great. Perfect. Okay. So thanks very much. And so I want to come at this theme of the political economy of technology, information, and media from a slightly more heterodox bent. And I actually really want to pick up on Leslie's excellent overview of the political economy of Sidewalk Labs, which I want to touch on very briefly. But I think that your sort of overview really touches on this emergent notion of platform urbanism. And so what I want to do is to offer what I'm calling a quote-unquote glitchy political economy of platform urbanism. So platform urbanism, really what it does is it marries the more recent articulation of what we're now talking about as platform capitalism, and then the material discursive kind of assemblages of the smart city. So very briefly, platform urbanism can be thought of as consisting of the market-driven, quote-unquote, disruption of city services, governance, and everyday urban lives by technology platform actors, right? So the Sidewalk Labs of the world and Ubers of the world as they remake cities effectively in their own image. And it also includes, to kind of pick up on Sarah Barnes, who's at Western Sydney, the sort of concomitant practices that respond to these new configurations between persons, networks, and infrastructures that arise from the effects of the real-time ubiquitous mediations of cities via technologies and platforms. So in many ways, this notion of platform urbanism really already advances or has inherent to itself, a political economic critique in the way that it gives emphasis to the ways in which cities have sort of been colonized as new sites for capitalist imperialism that Jathan Sadowski refers to as the techno-capitalist takeover of cities. So while I think that this critique is really warranted and necessary, particularly for the ways in which it renders legible how it is that platform actors and entities appropriate and shape urban environments as spaces for capital accumulation through the deliberate disruption of social contracts around labor, for example, or their disruption of modes of urban governance, such as housing regulation. These narratives of the techno-capitalist takeover of cities are often tendered or advanced as a kind of totalizing analytic or narrative that somehow suggests that platform urbanism is an inevitable eventuality, right? And a scenario in which anything and everything, so all aspects of urban life, all facets of urban environments, are somehow necessarily subsumed to the platform, right? So we can think of like mobility, right, is becomes Uber, citizenship, right, as something that's enacted through Facebook, housing, right, Airbnb, or even we can think of sort of urban job opportunities and kind of the, again, what Jason Sadowski has called the sort of urban hunger games over trying to recruit Amazon to various cities, at least in the United States, as an engine of urban job growth. But I think that there are some methodological and theoretical reasons for why we might want to look for alternatives to platform urbanism where it's being kind of advanced. It's this kind of foregone conclusion, because I don't think that it is, at least yet, empirically the case that the platform has overcoded the totality of the spaces and practices of everyday urban life. So, and one of the ways that I think that we can potentially meaningfully engage a more cautiously optimistic or hopeful political economy of platform urbanism is through the notion of the glitch, which really builds off of Liberty Russell's brilliant glitch feminist manifesto, in which the glitch can be thought of as the pixelated hiccup, the frozen screen, or the buffering signal that acts as a fissure. And it has this acknowledgement of an error, not so much as an error in and of itself, but as a much needed erratum in the sense of a correction to the machine and an inherent threat to normative and hegemonic systems. And so very briefly, I want to sort of identify three vignettes where we can maybe kind of see signals of this kind of like glitchy platform urbanism. And so the first is again Platform Labs, which Leslie just talked about. And specifically, I want to pick up on sort of some of the headlines that we've seen in the Canadian press and the international press as well. Namely that Sidewalk Labs hadn't foreseen that Canadians would be adamant that their data be retained within sort of Canada, within the country. And that it has been surprised by these concerns over data privacy, and that they are surprised by sort of the resistance to the project and the ways in which it is being sort of like negotiated in various kinds of civic actions. And so here I think we can potentially think of surprise as a glitch in and of itself, right? In that it kind of disrupts the platform's attempt at totally sort of collapsing either urban citizenship or of disrupting governance in its own interests of creating conditions for its own existence, even where this project is likely to go ahead, right? But this kind of surprise that it's something that is actually being negotiated, potentially a way of thinking of that as a glitch. Another example we can point to is the Delete Uyghur campaign that coalesced in response to what was perceived to be profit mongering on the part of Uber when it lifted its surge pricing during an immigration ban protest at JFK in early 2017. So rather than caricaturing sort of Delete Uyghur as an expression of resistance to the platform, because I think oftentimes we tend to frame these sort of actions as resisting the monolith, I think it instead points to the ways in which Delete Uyghur is a glitch, right? Because it precludes, again, in this case, the platform from subsuming the totality of political sensibility to itself, even where politics, in this case, personal politics, is being expressed vis-a-vis the platform in various kinds of ways, right? And it doesn't kind of disrupt platform urbanism totally and completely, because I think a lot of the sort of Uber riders at that point just switched over to its competitor Lyft at the time. And a third sort of vignette is what I'm calling the Uberless city, where we can look at instances where the platform is not actually present or available in spaces and times where we may expect it to be. So I'm originally from Vancouver, where Uber does not yet operate. I think we've heard that it's coming, but I'm not quite sure when that is. At least as of the last, when I was there 2 weeks ago, Uber still wasn't there. And so I feel every time I kind of come into Vancouver, I forget this fact. Like I forget that Uber is not available there. And I open my Uber app only to see a lack of phantom cars on screen within proximity of my real time location. So my point here is that that's almost a means of like inverting that glitch, right? Is that, but the absence of one platform, in this case Uber, doesn't actually compel me to install a competing app such as the e-taxi app in Vancouver, because I just don't want that many apps on my phone. But it's this kind of glitch that kind of points to the ways in which urban mobility, in this case, or at least my own sort of urban travels through the spatial fabric of Vancouver, have not yet become fully subsumed by the platform to the extent that my mobility does not cease to become possible in its absence. If anything, it compels me to take more public transit, which this is a great photo because it's right in front of one of the sort of SkyTrain stations in the downtown core. And so I think that these examples are important because they potentially sort of point to fissures, right, in this kind of notion of platform urbanism as a totalizing analytic, which is what Kate Derrickson has referred to as a foreclosing of the possibility of countertopographies that pixelate or create fissures within dominant capitalist neoliberal regimes. So for me, the glitch is counter topography. And just to kind of close with Liberty Russell again, I think that understanding or prefiguring the glitch as a correction to normative and hegemonic systems, even where that glitch is not necessarily intentional, is a positive and I would maintain hopeful point of departure. So thank you very much.
Hello, Sonia. I can't hear you, Sonia. Can you hear me?
Oh, here we go. Yep. So I was just going to pass it over to Daniel, but you're way ahead of me.
Okay. Right.
Perfect.
Great. Thank you. I want to build just a little bit on some of the things that Agnieszka and Leslie have said. I'll take a little bit of a different approach. So I'm going to be talk a little bit. Put this in the context of open government data and such, but I think for me, when we think about a number of these issues, the key driving question or the starting question has to be basically one, you know, the classic question of, so what's the issue or the problem to be solved here? And are we looking at ostensibly, you know, something that's supply driven or some sort of demand driven phenomenon when we're looking at these technological platforms and such? And when looking at these sorts of questions, for me, I always tend to fall back on good old Dallas Smythe, sort of one of the sort of the founding pillars of comm studies in Canada. And one of the things that Smythe had taught us about was really this question of examining the myth of technology, or in this case, we said the myth of the geoweb for the sake of our discussion, right? And the idea fundamentally here being that when we think about technology, it's not much point thinking about it as an artifact and the myths around it, but rather when we think about technology, there's six key aspects of it that we need to think about. And indeed, I'll add a seventh after this, but the first being bureaucracies, both public and private. The second being science, which is increasingly taken over by capital, which is the third aspect. The fourth, of course, is the machines or the artifacts that are created by engineers. Fifth is the ideologies, which provide the raw materials, the raw resources, if you will, by which propaganda that seeks to mold public opinion to accept the myth is perpetuated and created. There's a seventh element there that I want to just briefly mention, which I want to sort of anchor part of my comments today about, and that's labor. Within this whole context of sort of the digital society, network society, geoweb, platform societies, platform economies, we often tend to overlook the issue of labor. And I think it's important that we look at that. And this largely because, in fact, the flow of information within these settings is largely the product of human hands. The challenge for us is really to see the work or the labor that underpins the platforms, that underpins open government data, that underpins network economies. Within the context of open government data, simply because that's what I've been working on recently, you know, we can think here in terms of public servants having to decide upon which data to select. Indeed, verifying, cleaning the data in the Canadian context, certainly ensuring that the data that's made public adheres to the privacy standards, accessibility regulations, et cetera. Very importantly, updating and maintaining the data as it stays online for a while. Equally important as part of this whole process is the issue of training staff or training public servants in terms of what providing open government data means and entails. So the point here really is that when we think about these aspects in terms of the exchanging of information and such, certainly in the context of open data, that openness doesn't just come about magically. It's dependent upon human hands, basically to move information or to move data and to make it move across context or jump across context if we use Gregory Downing's ideas. Right? Now, in addition to this, a couple of things that we need to think about really is that making data open in this context, right, is really a resource-intensive process. And so certainly within the context of governments and making government information available, we have a desire to want to see that data is going to be used somehow. And here it's this question of use. Like, so the issue of use is again important too from the private sector side, but is the classic tension between thinking about information and data as a resource for citizenship that's governed by criteria of need, by issues of rights, by issues of commonality on the one hand, versus thinking about information and data as commodities for consumers that are governed foremost by market powers, right? Now, the issue of use in this context, whether from a government perspective or from a private sector perspective, is really key because that value in the data really comes about or is only realized by the degree to which that data or that information circulates from one context to another. So within the context of open government data and such, we have certainly in the Canadian context, government being hesitant to expend resources on putting information online that nobody wants to access, right? A classic example of this too, we can see in terms of resources being expended, is in the case of the UK in terms of vast sums of money being spent by town councils making budgetary information such available online and that information not being accessed by the most verified citizens, right? So the issue here, certainly in terms of the Canadian context in open government data, whether we're talking at a national level or whether we're talking at the provincial level of Ontario, but we see a shift in labor, we see a shift in the public sector cultures, if you will, we're in the public service. And this process, what we're experiencing really, is a dialectical process. So we have a particular sort of labor, in this case, public service workers, that are being mobilized to circulate information and data, with the whole idea here about open by default, open by design. And in turn, the opening of this information, this data, is meant to contribute to basically altering the parameters of public service work and what that entails. Right? So we have on the one side this aspect in terms of looking at the information workers in this regard. Now, the message here in terms of this overly quick sort of review of this is twofold. One, a key aspect of sort of resisting the message or resisting the notions of sort of the digital solutions discourse and not succumbing to this sort of historical amnesia but supposedly progressive and liberatory potential of information communication technologies risks on really digging beneath the surface and examining the information labor practices beneath the surface. What are labor practices behind the platforms, for example, if you will, right? I would add to that too that, you know, we can be media and data or information literate, but that literacy is incomplete if we don't have an understanding of the deeper context in which the information labor, the information works, takes place, right? In terms of, because that's the key aspect of delivering the promises of open data, right? There's another aspect of this as well that I think often gets overlooked, but that's worthy of mention before I wrap it up. And that's the issue in terms of worker labor with regards to citizen engagement, because we tend to put a lot of priority on citizen engagement in a number of these contexts. And there's two points I want to raise here. One is a propensity for us to often celebrate citizen engagement and participation without necessarily considering the ends of that participation. And so what happens really is we often tend to equate openness and collective action and peer production, these sorts of things, as somehow being more democratic. And we fall back into that position. I came across a really interesting article just last month by Benjamin McKean in The Jacobin, who was writing about the experiences of the NRA, which is well worth reading, I would suggest, to anybody who's interested in social movements and citizen engagement. not least because what it poses in terms of looking at the NRA is questions about, well, what happens when these supposedly democratic processes are used for anti-democratic ends, right? So this idea that, you know, greater participation is not ipso facto more democratic. In fact, that greater participation can in fact be very much anti-pluralistic. And I think that's something that we need to consider within these contexts. I think too, in terms of dealing with citizen engagement and the open government aspect of it for me, and it sort of links a little bit to the sidewalk labs and stuff too, but is that one of the key things, Leslie touched upon this, is the call for sort of wider civic engagement, wider civic participation. Absolutely. One of the things we certainly see in the Canadian context is that that civic engagement is woefully lacking. And oftentimes, despite really sort of valiant efforts by government to try and engage with the public, but it's actually sort of the public that's not engaging. This is, you know, we do have some civil society representatives that are doing a valiant job as well and stuff, but broader public engagement is lacking. So I think we need to work very much in that direction to bring this on the table. So I think when we think about a number of these issues, you know, one of the things that the tools of political economy can bring to the table for us, certainly in the context of the GeoWeb and the open government data and such, is to think that, well, openness in this context stands in relation to the real agents of technological change. Openness in this context really, it's an index of deeper phenomenons that are taking place in the real world. And that real world is one that consists of institutional change, power struggles, power plays, tremendous inequalities and such. So that those are factors that we need to open up and explore and consider when looking at these issues of the political economy, the information society and such. I'll wrap it up there with a sort of overly quick, overly broad comments and throw it open for questions.
Great. Thank you, Daniel. We actually have a GeoThink co-applicant, John Corbett, who has raised his hand to ask a question. So I'm just going to add him into our chat here. We should see him on the video feed momentarily. John, do you hear us? Okay, maybe that was an earlier question. So any comments from our, I don't have a video or mic. Okay, so John will have to resort to writing his question out to us. In the meantime, Leslie, I saw you nodding in agreement towards the end of Daniel's presentation there. Did you have comments?
Well, I have comments on both of the presentations. I love the idea of the glitch and Liberty Russell. And I haven't heard of Liberty Russell, so I'm really curious to know about her work. But some of the things that you were talking about, Agnesa and also Danielle, it brings up this whole idea of resistance. And so... the sort of theme, and so I'm nodding around and thinking about, speaking of resistance, I have my cat here.
Oh.
Hi, my name is Junior. I have this, so this idea.
We are very open with our data and all transparency on all levels here at GeoThink.
Yeah, he's kind of crazy. But if I do this, maybe he won't jump on my back. But this idea of resistance, and so, you know, the example of Delete Uber and other sorts of ways that, you know, people are trying to take action against, their concerns about Uber and the sort of, you know, widespread, egregious sexism of the company and whatnot. But also, Daniel, in terms of you know, other sorts of resistance that might be by workers that are, you know, asked to use and work with open data, but don't have the resources or the tools to do so. So I'm just curious what either of you might think about resistance. Is resistance futile? Is resistance productive? If we're thinking about, you know, the development and the deployment of a lot of these technologies, which very much is lots of ways that it is, you know, there's a techno-fundamentalism about it, or the sort of inevitability about the technologies. You know, a lot of the literature on platform, so I'm being groomed now, a lot of the literature on platforms from a critical perspective, of course, is taking umbrage at a lot of this technological solutionism or determinism and whatnot. But how can we be critically resistant, but offer good solutions moving forward for the public, I guess, or my question, folks.
I could try to address that. So for me, the glitch is useful because I think it captures sort of much more sort of mundane aspects of our sort of everyday engagements with technology. Because we have this like platforms as this monolithic and inevitable takeover of everything, right? Citizenship, governance. And I wonder if that makes it seem something that's totally and completely insurmountable. And then I think that the flip side of that coin is like resistance, that, okay, we must resist this. And then everything also gets kind of just relegated to this sphere of acts of resistance. And so the glitch, I think, is a much more sort of embedded in these very mundane practices, or very sort of these sort of just like snippets of space-time where there's some kind of like fissure, or, you know, what Liberty Russell calls a pixelation of something. So where Uber is not available, right? Or I can't actually get same day drone delivery. Like, there is no Amazon in New Zealand, right? Yet life still goes on. Literally, there's no Amazon. So life still goes on. And so where things have not become that it's not necessarily about resistance, because I think that too becomes very, not onerous, but daunting, right? That we have this responsibility to resist. I think your comments, Leslie, about policy and sort of like data governance are really, really key. And they have to happen at particular points in time, right? Like, because otherwise it's already a runaway train. So that's really important. But in terms of, yeah, there are acts of resistance, but I think that there's also these very kind of mundane moments. And I'm really, myself particularly, inspired by a lot of the work that comes out of feminist engagements, sort mm-hmm. of in digital sociology and sort of the digital archaeology, particularly the digital ethnographies kind of work that really, you know, emphasizes kind of like the very mundane and at times really ludic engagements that characterize our appropriations of technology. Where technologies are always going to be used for purposes, like they carry an inherent ambivalence, so we're always going to use them for purposes other than they were intended. And mm-hmm. our practices of resistance, so if I think of like locational privacy, which is something that I've written about quite a bit, right, that it's not a wholesale sort of resistance, right? Like, we may at times try to mask our location. We may at times kind of alter or dither our sort of locational privacy settings. But then at other times, we're perfectly happy to, or not happy to, but we give wholesale permission to sort of like various kinds of extractions of our location data, because there's a utility value, right, in kind of the service that we're getting. So I think it's very variegated and uneven. Glitch is kind of this very mundane sort of alternative to thinking resistance.
I like that. I think I would add, the thing that I would add in terms of the aspect of resistance, I think perhaps not so much resistance as the banality of agency, or the mundaneness of agency. And those in the face of a technological imperative or a dominant technological narrative that simply says, hey, you know, technology's coming along, it's doing this, there's no point, you gotta be a fool if you're not using Uber, you're a fool if you're not using this app, you're a fool if you're not doing this, right? And there's no point fighting it. Don't wanna change anything, everything's convenient, succumb to it. And I think that it's this aspect of simply saying, hey, without actively going out to try to resist in some senses, or just simply through my day-to-day actions of whether the choices that one is making, some of those can be resistance without the person actually even realizing that it's an act of resistance. It's just sort of the day-to-day user engagement with the different sort of tools and platforms. But it is a question of challenging this narrative of ultimately this narrative of sort of get a very sort of progressive view in terms of, you know, the smart city is a great thing. Well, the smart city may be a great thing, but it has an awful lot of implications in terms of surveillance. Right. It has, you know, it's not so great when we think in terms of arguments being advanced around the idea of saying, well, hey, the new form of civic participation is allowing yourself to succumb to surveillance. Well, maybe not so much. I think it raises these questions around us in terms of perhaps actually even calling into question in terms of how we think about resistance as sort of we're doing right now. I think as well, to come back to the early point, Leslie, that you raised about how can the critical studies offer solutions? I think, you know, that there's not basic is a question sort of, on the one hand, using the tools in this case of political economy, to work towards finding solutions and perhaps, I hate to say it, but sort of step away a little bit from the more sort of dogmatic critical side of it, simply because oftentimes that the critical label, if presented up front, becomes a question for, becomes an issue for not listening or an excuse for not listening. I think in many ways sort of critical political economy, here's a weird juxtaposition, but I think it has a branding issue, right? In the sense that we see the notion of criticalness oftentimes being marginalized simply because of that label. And so I think that in terms of that regard that, you know, and that's truly unfortunate because there is so much that it has to offer in terms of contributing to discussions about solutions. So I think that's part of the issue here that, that comes into play.
Absolutely. So we've got some questions here that I'd like to get to before we wrap up, because we're at almost 4:50 here. So an anonymous attendee has asked if there are any historical analogs that mirror these recent developments, or are we facing a new set of issues? That's sort of a broad question, but I certainly think the materiality and history of is an important one to bring up. So if we want to go there.
Yeah. I'm going to put it, the core issues I would say are ultimately the same in many ways, right? We can go back, look, go back to the introduction of electricity, go back to the telegraph, go back to radio, go back to TV. The core issues are ostensibly unchanged in many ways. The toys that we're dealing with are new. The speed and volumes of information and stuff that
the
we're
scale,
dealing with.
Yeah.
The scale is different. But at the core, many of the issues, I would say, I won't say identical, but awfully close to a lot of this. You know, so I think there's you know, one of the things that we are, unfortunately, in the series, we're very much sort of, we suffer from historical amnesia. And we're not sufficiently aware of sort of the history behind a lot of the information platform development. So I think that there's much to be gained from looking at the history in that regard.
Agreed. We have another anonymous question. Sort of switching streams here. It says new tech is built to create habit forming behaviors. Is it more important to counter predatory design or to offer alternatives? So, I guess this is panel wide. We could think about bias. I mean, if bias enters at any stage of the stack, really, I'm not sure if it's specific to design here, but anyone want to take,
sorry, can you repeat the question? So,
It says new technology is built to create habit-forming behaviors. So is it more important to counter predatory design or to offer alternatives, I guess, after the fact in terms of?
I will say both.
Yeah.
I will say we need to understand why predatory designs are built and how it sucks us in many different ways. And we need to think about alternatives. And the alternatives could very well be no technology. So I think we need to offer both.
I would, Agnieszka, were you going to say anything?
No, I'm thinking because that's a hard question to answer. Sorry, no, I'm mulling it over. Yeah.
I mean, I would build quickly on what Leslie's point is. I mean, the question sets up, I think, somewhat of a false dichotomy in the sense mm-hmm. I don't see why they would be mutually exclusive. Mm-hmm. The other thing to think in mind too is awful, you know, lots of designs fail. Changes take place, right? The question earlier about the history, if the history of technical change teaches us anything, it's always to expect the unexpected, mm-hmm. right?
And I think one thing about sort of the predatory sort of design of some sort of technologies, I think there's two issues. One is kind of this notion of the attention economy, right? Where all of these apps in particular, right? Because I think that's our front end experience of the platform, right? Is usually through the app, often mobile. Is that they kind of create this like economy where they want to, first of all, engage us and then sustain sort of the time that we actually spend within an app. And there's all kinds of like software that actually gauge that. And then kind of like repeat visits, right? Or repeat uses of those things. So we do kind of like live in this attention economy where, you know, we have feeds coming at us all the time and that they're quick and parsable, right? It's like we've moved on from 140 characters, like that is even too much. We just want pictures, right? I'm thinking of, you know, Instagram versus something like Twitter or Snapchat versus Twitter. But so that I think that's one issue. But then there is also this kind of question of like the predatory aspect of technologies or where various kinds of platforms are perceived to be acting in predatory ways. So going back to that delete Uber campaign, right? Which is kind of this perception that, and again, that it was acting in a way that was just like profit mongering by dropping its surge pricing at the time. And that can kind of get called out quite quickly. And again, I'm trying to think of what the language is other than resistance, but that there is a way in which sort of responses to these kinds of technologies get mobilized all the time. Or there, you know, there's a lot of, we hear a lot of instances of kind of like really sexist and misogynistic designs of various kinds of like applications, you know, or that are kind of sometimes advanced sort of facetiously, but they get, you know, we also live in kind of like an attention economy and then also a troll economy, right? Where these things just get trolled, right? And can kind of get kind of like relegated out to the periphery. You know, they get dropped from the App Store, for example, or the Google Play Store, which is that, you know, Apple and Google, they don't necessarily have, you know, I think they tend to present themselves as being fairly neutral, but like that are avenues for kind of eschewing predatorily designed technologies kind of out of the ether, right? I think it's about like the right moment and how sort of those kinds of things crystallize vis-a-vis particular apps or services, but yeah.
Absolutely. So John has chimed in with his question here that he wasn't able to ask live, which I guess is directed to you, Agnieszka, so we could stay here with the glitches. He's wondering if glitches are intentional or unintentional. The drawing open of the veil where we see glimpses of what lies behind, you know, no mention of the FB, so Facebook data uses, moments of weakness, et cetera.
Yeah. So I, thanks John for that question. I think that it's both, that it can be an intentional sort of like, we can think of the software bug, right, as a glitch, right? Which can be an intentional engineering of the glitch, of sort of rending open a particular kind of facial, or they can be totally and completely unintentional, I think as well. Like when I open my Uber app in Vancouver and again, there's no phantom vehicles within my proximity. So, and that both of those kind of like create these moments of kind of something not seeming quite right. And that's an opportunity for sort of new, I mean, I'm going to sound very social theorist, but like new lines of flight, right? Or departure from that. So both can be unintentional and intentional, right? You can have like a strategic glitchiness or sort of a more inadvertent one. And I think this point of drawing open of the veil, right? I think that the glitch is also open, important not only for what it's sort of like, that it kind of rends open the horizon of possibility, but also for what it renders apparent. And this maybe gets back to to an earlier question about sort of what is the responsibility of being critical, right? And I think for us, part of that is rendering certain things apparent, right? That are intentionally obfuscated in the services of or in the interests of hegemony and power. So the Facebook data use, right? So I assume, John, you're referring to the Cambridge Analytica scandal. Mm-hmm. Yeah, indeed. I don't know if that's really glitch or not. What I think is glitchy is kind of like it's public disclosure, right? Mm-hmm. Which I don't think it's at all surprising that was going on.
Was getting caught.
Getting caught, right? And I mean, I think we have to sort of acknowledge, right, that as like scholars, right, that academia was, part and parcel, complicit as kind of part of that activity. But then also the thing with the Cambridge Analytica scandal, one of the things that comes out is that, it wasn't actually all that effective, right? I think where things get really polemical is with the micro-targeting of fake news. And there was just this great piece in the New York Times around how Facebook is being used to spread fake news in sort of what we call sort of majority worlds. Particularly, they were looking at like Sri Lanka, where it's actually sort of like spewed a lot of misinformation and kind of like resulted in kind of like sectarian forms of violence, right? Mm-hmm. So this has real world consequences, this kind of micro-targeting of fake news. But with the Cambridge Analytica scandal, another kind of like glitch is that actually it wasn't all that effective because who was the Republican? Ted Cruz, right? Ted Cruz, I think, was wanting to use Cambridge Analytica to sort of help him sort of like micro-target in service of his campaign for president. And actually, I think that the consensus was that it was kind of this... And Brexit, it was kind of this money that was not well spent because it didn't actually arise in anything, not just because he didn't sort of win the nomination, but that they actually didn't find it to be quite so useful. So there's a lot of also like bravado about sort of what sort of micro-targeting with data can and can't do. Brexit, I have no comments on Brexit, perhaps one of the other panelists.
That's a whole other webinar, maybe. On Brexit. I'll just ask if there are any closing remarks here before we end at 9, or sorry, at 5.
9 for me. Liberty Russell, very easy to Google. Just Google Liberty Russell. And she's kind of like an artist, kind of public commentator, and also it's the Glitch Feminist Manifesto. And she has various kinds of like very accessible writings. All brilliant. Yeah. Fantastic.
I'm just writing it out here. So, that's the wrong one. And on that note, you can find all the PowerPoint slides, and the full recording of this session will be up on our website at geothink.ca, and we'll alert all of our Twitter users and everyone when that happens. So thank you to all of our panelists for taking time, and thank you to all of our attendees for joining us. Just another quick reminder, we've got the May session of the GeoThink and Learn scheduled for Friday, May 11th on the topic of citizen science and crowdsourcing. So you'll find more information about that on our website as well. But a huge thank you to all our panelists and attendees.